fellow travelers, and welcome to the Diverse in Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Curtis Clow. You know him as the writer of Beastlands and Majestic. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Clow. Welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good.
Thank you so much for joining me for the show.
Yeah, of course. It's always a pleasure to talk about comics, especially the ones that I make. So thank you for having me.
Oh, it's definitely my pleasure. So I always like to start off with a question of inspiration. So what comic books did you love as a kid, and what made you want to start writing for comic books?
So I only read a little bit of comics as a kid, Spider-Man, Wolverine, stuff like that. I started getting more into them like in the late teens and early 20s. And a lot of stuff from Image really spoke to me. A lot of Rick Remender stuff like Deadly Class and Low and Fair Agent. So he definitely greatly inspires me. And I always knew I wanted to do something creative, but as soon as I got into comics, then I realized it was definitely comics is what I wanted to make.
Most of your comics that I've read seem to be very much fantasy based. So what is it about the fantasy genre that interests you?
Yeah, definitely. All of my stuff is very high concept, either sci-fi or fantasy. And I think that's like pretty much what I'll always make. And I guess I just find that stuff more interesting to me, like being able to create all new worlds and characters in the world, and just that whole world building side where you kind of reveal like how the world works and everything. I just find that way more interesting to, as a consumer, like when I'm reading other entertainment, I like reading that kind of stuff. So like as a creator, kind of the same way.
A lot of fantasy, I notice when fantasy writers are putting in their stories, tend to have either a very much an allegorical aspect to them, and or especially a lot of other maybe symbols of things of that nature. When you're writing your fantasy, are you focusing, is there sign of like some sort of metaphor, symbol you're working in, or a concept that tends to be a standard theme for you?
Yeah, definitely. Like I think theme is like one of the most important parts in storytelling. So like with Slightly Exaggerated, that story is very it's kind of a deeper story about religion, death, and like leaving a legacy. So like that fantasy world is very interwoven with that theme, and you'll see a lot of like, religion and different religions in this world. It's all tied together for sure.
Now you're also the writer creator of a fantastic series called Beastlands, which was, I had the pleasure of reading, and thank you very much for that.
Yeah, of course.
Could you give our readers your pitch for the Beastlands series and what inspired the creation of it?
Yeah, so Beastlands is a story, it's a fantasy adventure world where some people have companion beasts. It's about a boy that has to save his beasts and friends before a king tries to execute them all. And, it's inspired by things I grew up with, like Pokemon and all of those, like, monster type stories and worlds. But it's definitely a more mature take, kind of like Pokemon meets like Game of Thrones. And it's kind of inspired by a more personal tale with my dog was hit by a car in like 6 years ago. So I tried to just, but she lived, but it just took a lot of extra care, caring for her and her recovery. So I tried to put that like human and pet bond into a story. And that's kind of how Beastlands was created.
And it's a beautifully drawn series. I mean, the images that are drawn by, I'll probably get the last name wrong, but I'm going to try it, Joe Mi-Gyong?
I mean, that's probably my best guess. We've only worked together over email, so I've never heard it actually pronounced either.
All right, so for the purposes of this interview, we'll say Joe Mi-Gyong. But yeah, I mean, it looks absolutely beautiful, that series. So how did you your partnership with Joe start?
I think I just found her art on social media, and this is her first comic, but I saw she did some like commission pages just for fun, and she did a lot of character art. So I just got in contact with her and asked her if she was interested in doing a comic, and then I found out that she had never worked on a comic, which is it's rarely that somebody's first comic will be as good as she was, but she's just that great of an artist where her first sequential storytelling was just already amazing. And I think she's only gotten better as issues go on. And now she's done a bunch of work for like Boom Studios and stuff and is just killing it now. But yeah, so luckily she said yes. And I sent her the pitch and she liked it. And then we just started working since then.
was there any concern of for the fact that it was her first sequential combo? Because sequential art and pinup art obviously is often very different things for stylistically, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Were there concerns on either side, the you or Joe, on can it work sequentially?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to speak for her, but I remember her being a little nervous and you know, about being her first comic. And I think her confidence only grew as we put it together. And then she saw the letters on the first issue. And I think her confidence just continued to grow issue after issue, where now she's done, you know, dozens of issues for comics. And I think she's just even better now. But I mean, with an artist that good, like, I wasn't that worried about it. And I had seen, it's not like I didn't see any sequential pages. Like, she just did some random sequential pages for commissions that I looked at before contacting her. So I saw those, and those looked amazing, like, as far as the storytelling on those, but it wasn't for like an actual comic or anything. But I mean, when contacting artists to work with and to collaborate with, you always want to see pages. Like, I can't just, you know, want to work with an artist based off of pinups or anything. You have to see how their sequential pages look.
And like I said, Joe did an amazing job. Once Joe became involved in the series, did her style or focus change or enhance how you proceeded with the story and pages?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a good collaboration, I think, will always enhance each other, whether the art or the writing. And for Beastlands, my idea for the art style was definitely this kind of like mix of an anime style almost. And that was right up Joe's alley. So once seeing her art for like the character designs and how good everything was, the Beast designs, like, it only enhances my writing for sure.
And yeah, and the designs are incredible. And as you said, the story centers around what's called Keepers, who are beasts who come to help those in need. Is there an age restriction? I mean, do they only come to children in need? Can the first keeper come be to an, go to an adult?
Yeah, there's that was just I kind of keep a mystery throughout the series. So in volume one, we kind of explain it as they come to somebody in need. But in the next volume, volume two, you'll see where somebody has a different thought and thinks that keepers only come to this brave and strong. So it's kind of like this lore in the world where people have their own ideas why keepers come and how it works and everything. Just depends on who you talk to from that world. But they can definitely come to adults or anyone else too.
Now, because keepers go to those in some sort of crisis, is having a keeper something that's desirable, or is it unwanted? Because once again, to have the keeper, you must also have the crisis.
Yeah, I guess it depends on how you look at it. I mean, I think once you would get a keeper, it would be pretty cool. But, you know, going through a hardship like that would be would obviously be a struggle going through that.
Have you thought to yourself who your keeper would be?
No, not really. I mean, I still have my dog that was hit by a car. So, I mean, maybe like similar to the main character's keeper, which is like a saber wolf type thing. But obviously, like, something with wings would be really cool too.
You know, it really is kind of cool. Dogs are the best companions ever, aren't they? I have one dog named Sydney, and she's fantastic.
Yeah, love them.
So the main thrust of your story has to do with the king who has determined that all keepers should be destroyed. Is that that's kind of the gist, correct?
Yeah. So he loses his young daughter in an accident with his keeper. And then that's where he kind of goes on this outrage and executes his own keeper. That was his own keeper since he was five. And now he wants to eliminate all of the keepers in the whole kingdom and eventually in the whole world.
Now, he's blaming the keeper for the death of his daughter. Is the keeper directly responsible for the death, or is it sort of like the keeper wasn't there when it was needed?
We kind of keep that vague, but I think, like, anytime you go through a tragedy like that, I think he's just trying to make sense of it, and he's just trying to put the blame somewhere. So I think it just for someone to lose like a daughter that young, and it's a king and he has the power to do something like that about it, as in like outlawing all of the keepers.
So the king isn't at this point rational at all. He's kind of snapped a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's gotta be brutal when you have a king or a leader who opinions aren't trustworthy at all any longer.
Exactly. Yeah. You see, like, in issue 3, he's talking to the queen and she's trying to talk some sense into him. And then that's where you kind of see that he's just lost it. He's there's no coming back from that.
So if all the keepers were to get destroyed, how does that impact the land itself?
That's a good question. If all of the keepers were actually executed and eliminated, I mean, that would impact the land a lot, because this whole world is set up so that humans and keepers thrive together. I think like good world building is you want this whole hook of this world is that some people have these giant companion beasts that are with them their whole life. So if that was eliminated, then the way things work in the world, everything would change.
In issue five, there's definitely the main character Mac is tossed into a pit, and there's a question of whether or not he'll be attacked by other keepers or former keepers.
Yeah.
So what happens when a keeper does go bad? I mean, are they, or do they become something else? What is happening there when a keeper that's supposed to be, I would assume, inherently good and protective turns?
Yeah, so that was the end of issue 3, where he's tossed into the pit, and those are a bunch of like starving beasts, and you know, they're like the size of a horse, and they all haven't eaten because the king is starving them in that pit, so they're just hungry. And I like to think of these as you know, sort of like real world animals. Like if you're tossed into a cage with a hungry tiger, it's going to come at you, and it's just its instincts. And I mean, even my own dog, you know, she snapped at me before and bitten me before. So I just like to think of these as like real world creatures. And it's not that they're evil, but it does show that maybe the king is right a little bit in wanting to outlaw them, that these things can be kind of vicious animals.
So is the keepers are something that's been around then with the humans for a long time? There's a long history of these connections.
Yep, exactly.
So, as you said, the king, he's not necessarily wrong that they could be destroyed. Is how much empathy goes to the king then for his situation?
Yeah, I mean, that was the goal with that scene and trying to create that and show like maybe the king's right. Maybe these things should be eliminated. Maybe they can cause pain and you know, harm people, and that the world would be better without them. So that's kind of like just seeing from the king's point of view when you have these hungry keepers trying to attack Mac and, you know, trying to eat them because they're hungry. But I mean, I guess that's what you're trying to do, is make some empathy. You have this guy who lost his young daughter, and then you kind of see his point of view where maybe he was right.
Are the readers going to have the opportunity to see what happened between the king and the daughter?
So far we haven't showed that. It is not shown in volume 1. It could happen in volume 2. We're still working on that, but it just depends if it fits right for the storytelling.
Now, I know when you're creating Beastlands, at least on the Kickstarter, I believe you said there's a 7-issue series. Is that volume 1, or is volume 1 the first 3 or 4 issues?
Volume 1 is issues 1 through 5, and we already did the Kickstarter for 6 and 7, so volume 2 will be issues 6 through 10, and then we'll see if we can keep going from there.
Oh, that's very cool. The intention is ongoing?
That's the intention, yeah. It just depends on, right now, Joe plans on drawing issues 6 through 10, so it just depends on if her schedule is open, if she still wants to draw it and still wants to work on it. But, I mean, I have ideas for, you know, up to like 5 volumes probably.
So since it's being written in a kind of with Kickstarter, an issue at a time, or with a campaign at a time, how does that affect how you approach the series? Because you kind of have to look at it in kind of like short chops. You know, the next one's funded. You got one more issue that you can come out with. Or are you just planning at, you know, and assuming you will make it to 15, 20, 30 issues?
I mean, I have all of that stuff outlined. I think for good writing, a good storytelling, you got to have a good outline way beforehand. So, I mean, I know what's going to happen in the story, and I have it really tightly outlined through issue 10, and I already have some of the scripts done. But then I kind of have, for the rest of the volumes, the ideas for continuing the story. It's not as tight of an outline, but I definitely have a lot of brainstorming notes on where those volumes would go and what parts of the world and what character arcs we would explore.
Is the world building more or less fun, you think, than the actual writing of the story?
I mean, world building is always fun. It can be a little too fun, where I see a lot of writers, you know, spend too much time and money doing world building when you got to actually write the story. But I love world building and, you know, creating these unique, strange worlds. It's just, it's really fun.
I mean, I assume that you've probably read something like Tolkien, where, I mean, that the amount of world building he put together, I mean, it's more world building than probably actual story in that series.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's, I guess my style of writing is I'm not trying to hit you over the head with it. I want to make sure I also tell a good story and good character arc. Otherwise, I feel like that whole world building stuff doesn't matter. But I just try to make it so it's kind of fluent and just kind of flows well with the story.
Yeah, and you know, and you have a great main character in Mac, who we'll say has a very interesting hero. He's also, I guess, the audience surrogate to kind of explain the world through him, I imagine.
Yeah, you kind of see his flashback of losing his dad, and then when he first gets his keeper and kind of not wanting it, and you kind of see his arc, and then you kind of see his journey of their kind of overarching goal, trying to find his father.
So once again, he's very loyal to his. To his keeper, Renzo, but he's also kind of a very reckless as a kid. I guess because he is young. Are we gonna find out more about what caused the keeper, what his need from the keeper, where that came from?
It's kind of explained in issue 3. I don't think we're gonna dive into it again, but it was just. I mean, you're definitely gonna see more of him searching for his father. That's kind of the overarching goal of all of the volumes. And you see when he's waiting for his father to come back in issue 3, and he just never comes back, and that's when his keeper comes.
So as he's searching for his father, is the story a little bit as well about maybe a growth for him as a character, and both maybe into manhood and responsibility? And how closely does the search for his father connect to what's going on with the king?
The search for his father doesn't connect with the king too much. It's kind of just like a side story right now. And and we have a bunch of these side stories, which would be volumes. And then eventually by the last volume, that's when we would wrap up, you know, what actually happened to his father and where he's at. But, yeah.
I mentioned a little bit of the idea of the keepers and the world that they exist within. So at certain points in the story, the keepers seem to show a strong, almost supernatural connection to one another. There's a scene where Luna knows where to find Renzo. There's also a scene that suggests something a little about the nature of the world that keepers inhabit, that there's like a unificating aspect to all the keepers. Is this something to be explored further? What does that say about the world they live in, where the keepers seem to have a deeper connection to one another, even if there are different species, it seems like?
Yeah, we definitely explore that in future volumes, and they definitely have a connection where they kind of communicate with each other. And yeah, how Luna could find Renzo and knew that Ava was in the kingdom. They do have this kind of supernatural connection, but I don't like over explaining things too much, so you just kind of see it organically happen throughout the story.
Yeah, I mean, I know you mentioned that one thing you do find interesting in fantasy is ideas of like religion and whatnot. Is that an undercurrent of this aspect of the keepers? Is there a faith or religious aspect to this world that connects to the keepers?
Not so much. It hasn't been explored yet, like in this volume or volume 2, but that's definitely like one of the volumes I definitely want to explore, that where they come across a group of people and kind of their thoughts with keepers and how they view them as like gods and stuff. But yeah, definitely in the future, that's something that I think would be interesting to see how that works in the world.
I mean, it must be really interesting and fun, and maybe even difficult as a writer to know the big story at the same time. You kind of have to hold so much back to build up to it. I mean, how do you balance that challenge of kind of holding back, you know, the details, but also presenting the story, giving enough information to kind of ground it for the reader?
Yeah, it's hard for sure. Like knowing that you have these ideas and plans for volume 3 or volume 4, and you're not even sure if you're going to get there yet, but you know, you're hopefully that we'll have enough success where we'll for sure get there. But it's hard to hold back because you have such like, you know, interesting things you want to tell about the story, but you kind of just have to, because if you did it all at once, then it would just kind of ruin the pacing and ruin the, I don't know. I feel like it would kind of ruin the world building, where you just got to take it slow.
How, I mean, it must be really exciting for you to when the issue comes out and getting these reactions and being able to explain the world just a little bit more, that must be a lot of satisfaction in getting these reactions and being able to reveal just a little bit more of what's probably been brewing in your head for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, this stuff has been in my head for years, so it's good to finally get some feedback on it. I mean, even now we just sent out the PDF for issue 7 to Kickstarter backers, and you know, I already have a few more issues written after that. So it's like, I'm already thinking about, you know, many issues ahead. So you're kind of, it kind of takes, you know, months to finally get feedback. And especially since this is more of a Kickstarter book right now, where it's not even like a monthly, you know, comic shop series where you're getting that reaction every month. This is like, you know, every 6 months, we're putting out the next two issues. So you're kind of getting feedback, you know, 6 months later.
And Beastlands is doing huge business on Kickstarter. I mean, without going to the exact numbers, I mean, you're making serious cash on this, these comic books through those campaigns. What has been the key, do you think, to the story's success on Kickstarter? Because, I mean, I know a lot of people, even including myself, who have struggled on Kickstarter, who've had, you know, campaigns fail or not be as big as you would as they would wish. What has been the secret?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I knew the secret. The most thing I can say is just staying consistent and starting small. Like we weren't always doing this big of numbers on Beastlands when we first started. It was only a fraction of that, like, you know, a small fraction of what we're doing now from the past two campaigns. So it's just about sticking with it and building up your audience. And if you're putting out a good product and a good story and a good book and it's high quality and you're fulfilling your Kickstarters on time, and you know, not even so much on time, it's not a big deal if it's late, but the fact that you're actually fulfilling your Kickstarters and sending out all the books, then you'll get repeat backers, and it just will keep growing year after year.
I mean, considering how many backers you have, it must be almost like a second full-time job to just fulfill all these different backers and all these rewards. You know, so you know,
no, it is full time for me. I quit my day job a few years ago, and now I'm just doing like freelance writing and Kickstarters full time now.
Is it a challenge to organize the fulfillment of these projects?
Yeah, definitely. That's it's definitely my least favorite part of Kickstarters and self publishing is the fulfillment side and shipping books myself. I still do it all myself. But I mean, you can't complain. It's a good problem to have, you know, a bunch of backers that you have to ship stuff to. I mean, you know, I'm glad it's a lot. You don't want it to be only a little bit, but it's definitely in the future. I could see myself, hopefully I can find the right partnership for like maybe a warehouse fulfillment that does good comic shipping. And that would definitely take a lot off my plate if I didn't have to do all the shipping myself. But for now, I'm still doing it all. And it's a lot of planning and organizing, especially since I'm doing, you know, multiple Kickstarters at once, fulfilling multiple Kickstarters together. It's a lot.
I mean, you're kind of like a small version of like Amazon at this point, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's a lot of storing comics, shipping supplies, all of that. So, I mean, hopefully I can find the right fit for like maybe a fulfillment partner one day. We'll see.
So Beastlands recently signed a publishing deal with Dark Horse Comic Books. What made Dark Horse the ideal home for your series?
I mean, Dark Horse is I think they're one of the top publishers, and they've been around for a while. And so, I mean, they're, you know, one of my favorite publishers. So when they got in contact and were interested in signing it, like, it was just, you know, a dream come true. They're one of the top tier publishers, and I think it's a good home for Beastlands that'll help get it out to a wider audience and into bookshops and comic shops and all that.
So the deal with Dark Horse, so once again, it kind of sounds like you're almost a publishing company by yourself. So how does Dark Horse really enhance the distribution and accessibility of Beastlands?
Yeah, so right now I only sell pretty much exclusively on Kickstarter. And Kickstarter, while it does have a strong fan base, it's only so big. Like, you know, the biggest Kickstarter we've done is like over 1,000 backers. But when you start talking about, you know, going into bookshops all around the world and comic shops and Amazon, like, that just opens you up to so much more of an audience and people that don't use Kickstarter. I wish all of those people still used Kickstarter, but this is, but, you know, Kickstarter's audience is only limited. There's still so many people that don't even know what Kickstarter is. Mm-hmm. And then also, this will be the first time you'll be able to get the first five issues collected into a trade. We've never done any, you know, any collections on Kickstarter. We only do issue by issue still.
Because of, I mean, obviously Dark Horse, a lot of their comic books are like monthly books, and Beastlands is connected to the campaigns on Kickstarter. Is there a change in how you have to, or the speed in which these books are released through Kickstarter to coincide with how Dark Horse tends to publish their books?
No, I mean, we've had this deal in place for almost 2 years now, so there's no really rush or anything. I mean, we still have 6 months before the actual release will be on June 28th this summer. So we still have a lot of time before the actual release, but we're just keeping it flowing. We have the freedom to, it's still creator owned, so we have the freedom to keep kickstarting issue by issue. And then if they decide to publish the volume two, then we'll already have it done for them.
Well, I mean, it really is amazing how well Beastlands is doing. And but of course, I mean, that's not odd for you. I mean, you have another series called Majestic that's also killing it on Kickstarter as well. I mean, you apparently hit home runs every time you come to bat, as it were.
Man, yeah. I mean, I just feel really fortunate and lucky to have, you know, to grow, to cultivate this kind of fan base that's interested in everything I make. Like, you see it sometimes where writers will have one popular series and doesn't really, you know, feed off into the other ones. But I've gotten lucky where, you know, all of my series have kind of just had this crazy success on Kickstarter now, that I feel like, you know, Majestic, that was my first one launching a full volume one instead of issue by issue. So it was a fun experiment and it paid off and did really well. So now that'll be like my first self-published full trade.
Very cool. Can you give our listeners the pitch for Majestic?
Yeah, I haven't had to pitch it at like any conventions or many interviews yet. So I'm a little rusty with it, but let's see.
Worries.
So it's a fantasy adventure series, much like my other ones. And it's about a shape-shifting girl that has to help a young outcast boy return home.
Oh, that sounds very cool.
Thank you.
So one aspect of Majestic that I read was that one of the major themes of the story is learning to love oneself.
Yeah.
And you have so how does that theme connect to, is it Lyra or Lara?
Lyra. Yeah.
Lyra and Mako. How does that theme apply to those two characters, and why is that an important one for you?
Yeah, so it connects to Lyra. She's this shapeshifter. She can turn into, you know, various, pretty much any like fantasy creature in this world, you know, big or small, strong and fast, but she hates her human form. So this is kind of a story about her learning to love her actual human form. She doesn't spend much time in her human form. And Mako is a young boy that she meets in her forest. She's kind of the forest guardian, and he's been outcast from his tribe and must prove himself a man before he can return home. So Lyra is kind of on this journey with him, trying to help him return home, and they're both kind of struggling with that main theme. And I just think it's an important theme. I mean, it's something I've struggled with, and unless you're like super confident or like a sociopath, like I think many people probably can connect to that. And there's always stuff throughout life where, you know, that you might not, you know, love yourself.
So Lyra's issue is an external one, in other words, her parents, and Mako's issue of loving himself is internal, of maybe manliness is a connection to his tribe.
They're both kind of like external and internal. For Mako, it's definitely the internal as aspect of trying to become a man, but also the external, that he might not be as physically gifted as other men from his tribe and as strong or manly. And Lyra, as I would say, is both. Like, it's definitely her human appearance, and she's just loves all these other creatures she can turn into, and she's not confident in her human appearance. But it's also kind of I guess the internal would be like the responsibility of being the forest guardian and the stuff she has to do and the sacrifices she makes and, you know, living in the forest isolated, just guarding it always.
It's another beautifully looking series. And it's another strong fantasy story, which once again, it's just another, it just goes once again, another home run for you. It sounds like, cause like I said, it's just these both series are doing so well.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. It's Anaku's on the art on that one. And we started working on that pitch. Let's see, like, I think about a year ago, and we had some publisher interest, but then we ended up just throwing it on Kickstarter. But yeah, her art's beautiful, and I think she's a perfect fit for the story.
So when's the next volume of Majestic going to be available on a Kickstarter?
So we will still be doing, finishing up all the art for this one for most of this year. Anniku's getting started on the art right now. So it'll probably take 9 months to probably finish all of the art and then, you know, get it printed and everything. But hopefully we can get the next volume out maybe late this year or early next.
Well, that sounds awesome, sir. And like I said, congratulations on how well this is all turning out for you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's definitely my pleasure. And Zulman, thank you so much for coming to the show. And I hope you have a fantastic night.
Thank you. You too. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a good night, sir.
You too.